This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by the civic engagement podcast, Future Hindsight. Join host Mila Atmos this week as she is joined by Aaron Haddon, a sociologist and author of Coerced, a look at forced labor in the U.S. Tune in to learn how labor under threat of punishment is still a problem in 21st century America, and how we can all work together to end it. Available wherever you get your podcasts or at futurehindsight.com. And now, this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, June 7th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Adam Weinstein, a research fellow at the Quincy Institute, on the question of, are we really leaving Afghanistan, and how will we leave it? Meanwhile, President Manchin vows to deep six the For the People Act and says no to filibuster reform. Or does he? Vaccination rates drop, imperil Biden's 70% goal. New poll indicates that masks, social distancing worked. Joe Biden endorses the expiration of enhanced unemployment benefits in September of this year. The G7 agrees to set minimum global tax. The New York Times says Donald Trump's chief of staff harangued the DOJ to investigate the steal, the stolen election. COVID relief turns out to be buoying state budgets. BB Net Not Yahoo all but gone. Hard right Naftali Bennett claims he seeks a unity government. Joe Biden rejects the latest Republican infrastructure barely offer. And lastly, a federal judge says California assault weapon ban is unconstitutional. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us. A couple of things. A federal judge in California, that assault weapon ban has been around for 30 years. That is a George W. Bush appointed federal judge. Just wanted to make that point. As I say, hello to Emma Vigeland. The beginning of another week. Here we are, Emma.
It is here we are.
It's a little bit warm in many places around the country. And summer is here. And Joe Manchin decided to make it maybe the worst summer ever. We'll see.
Jeez.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's a little bit of exaggeration.
Well, Joe Manchin certainly did kind of put a wrench in things over the weekend.
Without a doubt. Joe Manchin, this weekend, writing in the West Virginia Gazette, and we knew that he did not like the For the People Act. The For the People Act is S1. It is the companion piece to HR1. It is a comprehensive election integrity bill. Well, I don't know if I would use those words, maybe. It is a bill it is an election integrity bill. I just don't like to use those words because that's the way the right wing has been sort of foisting this idea of election fraud. But it would keep people from being disenfranchised by Republican measures in the states. It would also provide matching funds for candidates in certain circumstances. It would provide for independent redistricting commissions. It would also require a lot of disclosures when it comes to where your money comes from. all of these things apparently somewhat problematic to Joe Manchin. Sees that as somehow by more partisan. He has said in the past, and he said recently, that he is in favor of the John Lewis voting measures, which would reinstitute some of the preclearance provisions and would do a lot of like the election protection stuff, if you will. However, and I want to get the, well, let's let him say this in his own words. Here he is on Face the Nation this weekend.
Let me ask you about voting rights, which is another issue. You have an op-ed in the Charleston Gazette today. Again, it's an issue you want bipartisanship on. When you talk about deliberation and the Senate slow moving being one of its great functions, Democrats would say, while you're waiting for bipartisanship, what's happening in the states is 300 or so bills promoted by Republicans to limit voting rights, changes in the ability to overturn elections if Democrats win. They say you can't wait. While that's happening in the states, for voting rights to pass by a bipartisan margin in the Senate.
Well, John, we have two bills before us, okay? We have the Voting Rights Act, which has passed over five times in our history here since 1965 in a most bipartisan way. And now we name it appropriately the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. We can expand that to all 50 states. We can do so much more with that. And it's starting out to be bipartisan. I have Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska signed on in a bipartisan way. And we can work on that one, which truly does protect the voting rights.
But I guess, Senator,
Before the People Act is much greater.
If I could just interrupt, you know politics and how it works. Why would Republicans, when they're making all these gains in the state houses and achieving their goals in the states, why would they vote for a bill someday in the Senate that's going to take away all the things they're achieving right now in those state houses?
John, they achieved what they've achieved before they weren't thinking they had to make changes. Why in the world would they want to make changes that basically subvert? Because I can tell you what goes around comes around. It could be more damaging to them, too. The bottom line is the fundamental purpose of our democracy is the freedom of our elections. If we can't come to agreement on that, God help us, John. And someone's got to fight for this. And we've got to say, listen, the divided country that we're in today, the insurrection that we saw January the 6th, if we don't try to heal that, if we don't make every effort and go beyond the call of duty, then what are we and who are we? We've been known to go around the world and promote democracy and observe other elections. What kind of credibility do you think we have in doing that today? So I want to fight for this, and I think the Republicans will fight for this and understand we must come together on a voting rights bill in a bipartisan way. You can't divide our country further by thinking you've given leeway to one or the other. And if they think they're going to win by subverting and oppressing people from voting, they're going to lose. I'll assure you they will lose.
That's not true. I love the logic there. One, the United States going around promoting democracy internationally. Let's all laugh. Latin America is laughing with us, right? South America is. But I mean, the other aspect of it, which was infuriating to me, the idea that Republican bills in these state houses are going to counteract the gains that they made in the past how many so years, right? No, they're looking at their victories and they're building on them. They're trying to find a way to make voting even more undemocratic. So, because they learned their lesson. Wow, when we actually limit Black people, poor people from voting in these states, we win. So let's make sure we compound that. And so it's completely faulty logic that he's using. I mean, he's not operating in good faith. He's working backwards.
I don't even understand. I don't even, I mean, you could look at the look on Dickerson's face when he's saying this. Like, what you're saying is completely incomprehensible. He's working
backwards from his conclusion, which is bipartisanship.
Well, he's saying that if they pass this, it's going to come around and be a problem for them. And Dickerson asked him, like, well, look, you have them passing it in the states. Why would they then pass a bill on a federal level that will undo the things they're doing in the states? And Manchin has no answer for this because he knows he's lying. Put up that tweet from David Sirota that has two headlines from West Virginia, the West Virginia Gazette. Really? I get what, maybe 4 or 5 months apart? I don't know. Put that up, Brendan. Here it is, West Virginia. This is March. West Virginia, not even 4 or 5 months apart. West Virginia Senate passes a bill to rein in voting options just, I don't know, 2 months ago, March 24th. And here's the next one. Joe Manchin, why I'm voting against the For the People Act. And the reason is because he doesn't believe in partisan changes to the voting rules. It is, look, this is absurd. And there's really two ways you can look at this. One is you can take Joe Manchin at his word, particularly when it comes to the filibuster, where he says that I will not vote to weaken or eliminate the filibuster. That's what he wrote as a quote in his op-ed in the West Virginia Gazette. Now, Joe Manchin has in the past said, I will not vote for things, and then voted for them. Joe Manchin also said we should have a $4 trillion infrastructure bill, and then it sort of walked away. He also said that we should have a talking filibuster and doesn't seem to remember that he said that. So one version of the way you interpret this is we got to take Joe Manchin at face value, and that's it. Bottom line, you need 10 Republicans to vote on the John Lewis Voting Rights Act bill, which I think is a pipe dream. And for anything else that doesn't involve reconciliation, you got to have those 10 Republicans. Or the other one, and this is really, you pick it, folks. It just depends on how optimistic you want to be. Joe Manchin needs to perform for West Virginia voters. And when he was on CNN a week ago saying, we're not there yet. We don't need to break the country. The Republicans will come around. He wasn't as explicit as he was in West Virginia. Hard to know whether he's sophisticated in, you know, determining who he's talking to at any given point. But we know Joe Manchin feels it's incredibly important for him to be seen as not going along with those hippies in the Democratic Party. And I'm just giving the optimistic perspective. We can't shake our heads because we're in an optimistic mode.
Are we? Because I'm certainly not.
I'm trying to, and I can tell you're not. When we're in optimistic mode, you got to be optimistic.
Well,
Joe Biden
can't police my emotions. Good
Joe
sir.
Joe Biden may have thought that he was helping Joe Manchin out when he says my friend votes with the Republicans more than he does the Democrats. That Joe Manchin, you know, might play that on a loop for his reelection campaign.
So, I know. We just need AOC to speak out against him, and then exactly. He'll have all the ammo he needs.
But
he points out the Voting Rights Act being passed in a bipartisan fashion. The reason we need to pass like the For the People Act was to re-implement a lot of what was in the Voting Rights Act because the Supreme Court said, oh, the Southern states aren't racist anymore. Don't worry about it.
Right.
So it's just like we're going backwards in a Republican partisan fashion. And he just like obscures that fact for his own branding exercise. It's just maddening.
Yeah, I mean, it is maddening. And like I say, if folks need a thin reed of optimism to hold on for, maybe Joe Manchin needs to go through this whole little playlet before he will vote to do some change to the filibuster that doesn't weaken it. It just makes it better. And by better, it ends up weakening it, but he'll never refer to it as weakening it. All I can tell you is that the strategy of politicians doing and saying horrible things as a way of giving themselves oxygen space to move is not unprecedented. Barack Obama, I'm not saying it works, but Barack Obama deported more people in this country from this country than any president prior to him. And he did so as a way of trying to buy credibility so that he could go and do some immigration comprehensive reform. It was a fool's errand. It was a horrible and inhumane strategy, and it failed. But I'm just saying that so that you understand that politicians sometimes think that way. Joe Manchin may be thinking, like, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say it in West Virginia, and I'm going to lock in that sort of cosplay narrative I have there because that's my brand. I don't do what the Democrats want. I'm an independent guy. I shot the cap and trade legislation with an AR-15. That's the type of guy I am. And maybe then he goes and does it, and he does it in a way that it's a little bit more obscured than your average person in West Virginia, your average person in anywhere in the country cannot tell you that if it's a filibuster that requires 40 votes as opposed to requiring 60 votes to break it, but you need 40 votes to hold it. They can't necessarily tell you that there's anything different there, but those of us who follow this on a regular basis know that it's a difference. And so who knows? But if you want optimism, there it is. Enjoy it, because that's all I got for you. Emma?
Yeah. I thought that was an easy transition into our...
Well, we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Adam Weinstein. He is a research fellow at the Quincy Institute. And we will talk about Afghanistan, where we're at now, where we hope to be, and what the prospects for some semblance of peace in Afghanistan look like. We'll be right back after this.
It's Monday, Sam.
It's Monday. I know. I'm doing my best to make people, to provide some, at least the optimism option. That's actually
kind of a good name for a show.
Yeah, I was going to say the optimism option. Meanwhile, I'll tell you why I am in such a good mood, because I know that my Carson Slim Space Dye Polo is on the way.
Ooh.
Yep. And I also ordered, I can't remember the name of it, but I got another button down too. So there's going to be some new shirts in the rotation, folks, because I can't wear a long sleeve forever. Not through this type of heat. As you know, shopping can be daunting. You never know if things are going to fit. Returns are a pain. You don't know where to start. If you're like me, you have absolutely no idea where to look for clothes or what kind of clothes you like. Well, Stitch Fix does all the hard work for me. Stitch Fix offers clothing that is hand-selected by expert stylists for your unique size, style, and budget. Every piece is chosen for your fit and your life, so you can look and feel your best. You try on pieces at home before you buy. You keep what you love. You return what you don't. Stitch Fix has free shipping and easy returns or exchanges. Prepaid return envelope is included. You don't have to go online and print out a label. None of that. There's no subscription required, and you pay just a $20 styling fee for each box, which gets credited towards pieces that you keep. There are no hidden fees ever. Stitch Fix has a style and styles and clothing that'll fit any occasion. They have for women, they have for men, they have for kids. They ship all over the U.S. It's available in the U.K. as well. You can also just go on, and they've got, like, you know, you start to do, like, I like this, I don't like this, and they create basically your profile, the type of clothes you like. Those are the ones they show you. You just go in, you could shop for a piece or two. That's what I did this time with my short sleeve shirts. Yeah, that's what I did.
Yeah.
And I'm probably going in there getting some shorts soon too. So there we go. No more. I'm not going to write off those type of shorts. The things that allow me to carry a bunch of stuff, but a couple of shorts that I'm going to wear, like, you know, and look like I'm have some measure of style. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. And folks, days like today, I was out there on the field. Saul had two baseball games this week. I'll give an update later maybe as to how they went. But I can tell you, we were out there. It was incredibly hot. Had him drinking water, but also had him drinking liquid IV. I don't want him to go and get that, drinks, the hydrating drinks with all the chemicals and the garbage in it and whatnot. And the beauty of the liquid IV I gave him, the tangerine flavored, which is the hydration multiplier plus immune support. Maintains and strengthens your immune system and it keeps you hydrated. The Hydration Multiplier Plus Immune Support is a cutting-edge blend of vitamin Z, zinc, and Wellmune in convenient single-serving packets to help you strengthen your immune system. Zinc supports immune cell health and function, and Wellmune is a naturally sourced beta-glucan that's proven to help strengthen your immune system. Each packet bursting with fresh, natural tangerine flavor. It tastes so good, even my kid loves it. Liquid IV can provide 2 to 3 times more hydration than water alone. This blend is powered by cellular transport technology. It's designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other nutrients. The company has donated over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. Products are being donated to hospitals, first responders, food banks, and more. Folks, every day, I got my green matcha right here. And at the risk of a little bit of embarrassment, pina colada. It's a pina colada.
You think it's embarrassing, but no one cares.
I guess maybe people don't care, but in the past I've been made fun of about the pina colada stuff. So, but it's delicious. It's really like coconut, but with a little bit more fruity, but, I drink it every day in the morning. I'm done with my coffee. I replace it with some of the matcha. I just have some extra water with it, so I'm more hydrated, but I also get the energy on the matcha one. And then, the other day I had a little bit too much drink the night before. You probably didn't even notice it when I was doing the show because of my liquid IV. You can get your liquid IV hydration multiplier plus immune support at bulk at Costco or order online. Get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. And then lastly, folks, very hard to find natural products. You got to go all over the place. Cleaning products I'm talking about. But there is one marketplace where it's a one-stop shopping for all of your natural goods. You can go to grove.co. Super easy. It's the Grove Collaborative. It's the online marketplace that delivers healthy home and beauty and personal care products directly to you. Grove Collaborative takes the guesswork out of going green. You can browse the site for thousands of home and beauty and personal care products. They're all guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. I leaned on these guys heavily during the lockdowns and the pandemic. We are just about in the studio to go all Grove branded packages of soap that I then put into the Grove. They've got soap dispenser pumps. But as of now, I still have some of that seventh generation, all unscented, of course, both our dishwashing liquid and our hand soap and Mrs. Myers. I use that for my laundry, simple ones, nothing floral, but it's fantastic. You can get all sorts of great natural products there. You can join over 2 million households who have trusted Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier. I got actually a fruit scrub brush too. That's pretty good. Plus shipping is fast and free on your first order. Check it out. Making the switch to natural products has never been easier. For a limited time, when our listeners go to grove.co/majority, you will get to choose a free gift with your first order of $30 or more, but you have to use our special code. Go to grove.co/majority to get your exclusive offer. That's grove.co/majority. As always, we will put this stuff in our description, in our podcast and YouTube. Okay. Want to welcome to the program Adam Weinstein. He's a research fellow at the Quincy Institute, focuses on security, trade, rule of law in Afghanistan and Pakistan, veteran of the Marine Corps and the war in Afghanistan. Adam, welcome to the show. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's just start where we're at. Joe Biden had announced, maybe it was a month ago, maybe it was a little longer, that we would be, that we were not going to make the May deadline, but that we were going to be pulling out of Afghanistan before 9/11, unconditionally so. My understanding is that timetable has been sped up by the military anyways.
Well, I think the timetable that President Biden announced was a rough estimate to give the military enough time, but they found that they were able to do it quicker. And of course, there is an incentive to do it quicker rather than draw it out, I think.
What would that incentive be?
Well, I think the longer you draw out the withdrawal, the more risk there is to the remaining U.S. troops, risk of attack, things like that. So I think once the decision was made, there was a motivation on the part of the Pentagon to get folks out as quickly as possible.
So what is the status now?
Well, DOD doesn't announce exact figures of how like what percentage they're at. They give ranges, and the last range I heard was approximately 25%. But again, that was about a week ago, so I suspect it's a little bit more now.
And from your perspective, what makes this withdrawal, which we've seen announcements before this, what makes this different?
Well, I think what makes this different is that they're closing down major bases. You saw that they withdrew U.S. troops from Kandahar airfield. They appear to be closing down Bagram. So these are giant military installations versus what we saw in the past was these military installations remained intact. And the number of U.S. troops was lowered. But now we see the United States handing over its major military installations to the Afghan security forces, which we haven't seen that before.
What the Afghan security forces, to what extent can they, I mean, give us an assessment of their ability, I guess, and really what their, you know, what is it that we, obviously they defend the Afghani government, right? But I mean, what do you imagine is their, you know, how are they going to approach this? What is their purpose at this point? And how well will they be able to use those bases? Because the real question here seems to be, at what point does the Taliban take over Afghanistan?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Taliban have captured a few key districts around Kabul, which is the capital, but not in, you know, around provinces that are that encircle the capital, but they haven't, you know, I don't think they have the ability to take major provincial capitals just yet. It's to be seen how the Afghan security forces, you know, prevail or don't prevail. They've had some successes and they've had a lot of failures. There are plenty of outposts that have been overrun, but the special forces and even some of the conventional forces have been able to thwart Taliban attacks. They lack the technical capacity that the United States provided. For example, there's a lot of questions about whether they'll be able to maintain their helicopters or continue flying them without the United States and without contractors. But on the other hand, I think the real question is going to be, is there a resolve to fight? And does the leadership of the Afghan security forces, you know, fragment or not? Because you could also make the argument that with the withdrawal of U.S. troops, there will be greater resolve to fight because, you know, they can't rely on the United States anymore. So I think, I guess the conventional wisdom would say that the Taliban are slowly going to gain territory and ultimately a future government of Afghanistan will be Taliban dominated. But I don't think that's what's going to happen in the short term, as in a year out from now. And I don't think that's set in stone. I just think that's the safe bet, but it's not for certain.
So give us a sense of once, and we're, so if 25% have been drawn down, and the original figure, at least at the time of the announcement, was about 2,500 U.S. troops. We're at, you know, I don't know, and then another week, maybe we're at 1,500 troops, 1,700 troops, somewhere around there that are still in. Once those 1,700 are out of country, they have officially handed over these bases to Afghan security forces. Who remains in the country that is not, well, or that has been in there under the, you know, under the auspices of this war that has been fought for 20 years?
Well, I mean, for example, Turkey, if I understand your question correct, I mean, Turkey is going to be managing the Kabul airport. They took on that responsibility. And of course, that airport is critical to the continued functioning of the Afghan government and even the Afghan security forces. So there will be a Turkish presence there. It remains to be seen whether U.S. contractors will stay in some capacity or not. Right now, it appears as if they're leaving, but who knows? Obviously, Pakistan, Iran, Russia, India, these regional countries will always have some influence in Afghanistan. So, I mean, there's going to be non-Afghan actors that are inside Afghanistan, but I think it's going to be significantly reduced, and we're going to see what happens in an Afghanistan that that doesn't have NATO troops there.
So the NATO troops, Turkey is there under the auspices of NATO, and is that it for the NATO complement of troops? Just Turkey at the airport?
As far as I, you know, I'm not aware of all of the inside planning, but the major contingents of NATO troops, such as the Germans, the Italians, they're leaving. So Turkey agreed to provide security for the airport and run it, essentially manage it. And so we'll see. I mean, perhaps it's not correct to say they're even providing security. They're essentially just managing the airport and ensuring that it remains functioning.
And again, on contractors, we are not leaving. There supposedly will be no American contractors there.
Yes, supposedly there'll be no contractors. But then again, I think that's a bit of a gray area, because we saw that some of these contracts for the contractors extend beyond the withdrawal deadline. But if you listen to some of the congressional hearings and some of the administration's testimony, it appears that the U.S. contractors are leaving, but perhaps some of the money that the United States provides to the Afghan government can be used for other contractors, for example, contractors from Eastern Europe, as an example. So I don't think there's going to be an end to contractors. I think there's going to be an end to American contractors. And of course, I'll believe it when I see it.
Right.
Know? Yeah. I mean, there's a piece in the New York Times today about the CIA being concerned about some sort of black hole of intelligence once there's a troop withdrawal, right? So, I mean, I'm just curious, what kind of intelligence infrastructure do you think remains?
Well, it's going to be diminished. I mean, that piece was talking about how the United States is in negotiations with Pakistan to possibly use a base inside Pakistan or create a base or whatever arrangement they come to. And then, you know, the United States is still looking at Central Asian countries. But I think the intelligence gathering capacity will be diminished. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be diminished. But when you have U.S. troops on the ground, or you have a commando raid, and they, you know, detain folks, they pick up what's sometimes referred to as pocket litter, the USB drives, the notes, the phones, anything you might find that could be used to disrupt a terror network like Al-Qaeda, that human intelligence capacity is going to be diminished. It's my personal belief that keeping U.S. troops in Afghanistan for that purpose, you know, when you do a balancing test, it makes more sense to withdraw. I don't think that the costs of staying in Afghanistan are worth whatever benefit and intelligence generating that we get. But objectively speaking, there will be a reduction in that intelligence capacity.
I want to circle back to that cost benefit analysis, just get a sense of what the costs are associated with it. But how is it? I'm reading that same Times piece, and apparently CIA chief Burns is in Pakistan. We know that Pakistan is not going to jeopardize the Taliban, at least the Taliban that they, you know, have the best relationship with. You know, it's possible there could be some like elements of the Taliban that they decide are no longer useful to them. How is it that, you know, and when Biden first made this announcement, we kept hearing there was going to be, you know, what is it, a response within the horizon or something, where people could, where, you know, our special ops or whatnot could get into the country and supposedly have the ability to sort of wage some form of covert warfare. How is it that the CIA, and I'm not saying that they should, I'm quite happy, I would be quite happy if I felt like they had no ability in that country whatsoever, but how is it after 20 years they don't have a plan B other than us being there? I mean, is that credulous? I mean that just seems unlikely to me.
Well, I think a more accurate way to put it would be they have a plan A that they want to do, and they're begrudgingly doing their plan B. I think the Pentagon and the intelligence community is, you know, they sometimes they don't plan for things they don't want to do. Other analysts have made that point, and I think it's a valid point. They're used to getting their way over the last 20 years. I think some folks in the Pentagon might be surprised at the course of action the Biden administration has taken, and certainly perhaps in the intelligence community. Do I think they don't have a plan B? No, I think they have a plan B. I just think it's not the plan B that they want, but there's deep relationships, especially between the intelligence community in Pakistan and in the United States. And even when relations between Pakistan and the United States are dysfunctional, those ties between the two respective intelligence communities have always remained. And I think there's a lot more cooperation than it is probably seen on the surface. And there are a lot of non-state actors and terrorist groups that both countries prioritize, you know, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and Khorasan province, which is the South Asian version of ISIS, and TTP, which is the Pakistani Taliban, which, you know, the Pakistani state does challenge. They might see differently on the Afghan Taliban, but this has been one of the or perhaps the crux of why we weren't able to achieve the outcomes we wanted in Afghanistan. It's not so much that Pakistan wants the war in Afghanistan to continue. Pakistan would rather see a stable Afghanistan, and the United States would rather see a stable Afghanistan, but it's a matter of the ordering of preferences, where Pakistan would rather see an unstable Afghanistan that's not friendly with India than a stable Afghanistan that is friendly with India. And very early on in the war, when the United States was backing the Northern Alliance, that really shook the Pakistanis, because the Northern Alliance had a close relationship with India. And the government that emerged after the US invasion, of course, to this day has a close relationship with India. I think Pakistan inflates that threat, but perception is reality in international relations to some degree. And from the Pakistani perspective, they'd rather have an unstable Afghanistan than one that they view as aligned with India. So that's it's an ordering of preferences issue, where Pakistan and the United States has never been on the same page about the Afghan government or the Afghan Taliban. But now that U.S. troops are leaving, the priorities change for Washington. They don't care about the Taliban or state building so much. Now they care about terrorism. And when it comes to counterterrorism, Pakistan and the United States perhaps have more interests in common than some would like to admit. And so I think the backup plan for the intelligence community in the U.S. will be to use some of these regional relationships to continue a CT war. Of course, they might have a more ridiculous backup plan, which I also saw reported, which was to basically back local militia leaders in Afghanistan to continue to have access to the country. I think that would be missing the forest for the trees and creating a very destabilizing situation for the sake of having access.
What other players have strong interest there, and how do they play out in that order of preference? I mean, so if I hear you correctly, you're saying that from the United States perspective, combined with Pakistan's perspective, the thing they can agree on is look, if you need to have a incredibly repressive regime there to feel safe, because it's the, because the, you can be sure that they're not going to be have a relationship with India. What we need from you is just some type of mechanism or guarantee that we're not going to have international terrorists from there. And as long as the, you know, as long as we don't have that problem, we won't interfere with your problem. And, you know, ultimately it's just the Afghani people will suffer more, but that is the, that seems to be like what happens with Afghanistan, is that all these major players come in and the people there are just basically chum. What is there another major player who is also involved in this calculation, or is it, or you know, are those the United States and Pakistan the two, you know, does everything drop off from there in terms of like influence?
Yeah, I mean, I think you paraphrased it quite well and really bluntly, and I mean that is the situation. I think the United States and Pakistan are the two most relevant outside players when it comes to the future of Afghanistan and the current situation. Russia matters, India matters, Iran matters. And many, you know, again, this, some of this dysfunction perhaps will be reduced when US troops leave. For example, Iran would rather see a stable Afghanistan that has, that doesn't have a government with the Taliban in control. But so long as US troops were going to be in Afghanistan, the Iranians were perfectly happy to give a little bit of support to the Taliban to sort of keep the Americans on their toes. So some of this dysfunction that played out was precisely because U.S. troops were in the country. Doesn't mean that when the U.S. troops withdraw that things will necessarily change for the better for Afghanistan, certainly not in the near term. I think you're right that Afghans are going to be the ones that suffer as these different countries play out proxy conflicts with one another in Afghanistan. But I think there is an opportunity here where all of these countries, China, Iran, Russia, the United States, Pakistan, have terrorism concerns. All of them don't want, none of them want a raging civil war next door if they can avoid it, that has, you know, spillover potential. And perhaps if the United States is willing to engage in aggressive diplomacy, it can avoid some of the worst consequences, you know, of the situation on the ground. I don't see a situation playing out where the Taliban don't end up being a very powerful force within the Afghan government. I think in a best case scenario, you get a political settlement where the Taliban have substantial power. And in another scenario, the Taliban take power through fighting and, you know, over time, gaining significant territory, and there might be pockets of resistance that remain outside Taliban control, but they end up getting the majority of the country. And in an absolute worst case scenario, you just have a civil war that rages for another decade and everything that comes with that.
Well, I read, I guess it was today maybe, or sometime in the past couple of days, that the US has earmarked over $200 million to the Afghan government. Which I, you know, on a day that Jeff Bezos announces he's going to, I don't know, go to the moon in his own private rocket worth billions of dollars, just seems almost laughable. Like, it's almost hard to imagine that somebody said, let's write up a press release about this for $200 million after everything that we have done to that country. But I also read a roundtable that you had in January. I don't know if you actually convened it in person or how you did it, Zoom, but it reads as if it's a roundtable with Afghanis who were talking about the various possibilities for peace. And the one thing that, that really struck me, and I can't recall who it was that said it, that there is a feeling that if there was no outside influence, that the Afghanis as a people would figure out some type of power sharing, whether it was regional, tribal, or whatnot, that would create an equilibrium, which might, you know, prevent any sort of major conflict. What are the prospects for that? I mean, how is there not something that we could do to provide Pakistan with some sense of security, so that they don't have to provide so much support for the Taliban, so that there would be some, you know, feeling that the Taliban needs to make, you know, some type of like relatively quiet peace? Or is there just too many interests there and too much, you know, I guess money to be made in conflict?
Well, the analyst in me says that it's not going to happen because there's too many interests. But perhaps the part of me that thinks the United States should still be proactive in diplomacy says that, well, at least we can try, and not try militarily, but try through diplomacy and other types of leverage. I mean, I think another thing in that roundtable that folks said was that there needed to be a more decentralized government. I think it's true that without outside influence, Afghans would probably find some kind of equilibrium with one another and it would be less violent. But that's not the reality for Afghanistan. In many ways, it's functioning as a rentier state. Its armed forces are completely reliant on U.S. funding. Its economy is completely reliant on aid. It's a country that it's an inconvenient truth, but will always to some degree be living in the shadow of Pakistan, at least for the foreseeable future, because Pakistan is such a larger country and has a more powerful military, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know that the United States can truly alter Pakistan's calculation when it comes to Afghan Taliban. Some folks have said, well, you know, label them a state sponsor of terrorism or use all these sanctions. Sanctions haven't really worked in the past to influence their behavior. I think we saw it didn't really work with Iran. A maximum pressure campaign didn't work with Iran. I don't know why we'd replicate it with Pakistan. The United States is not going to label Pakistan a state sponsor of terrorism because for the simple matter that the United States is not going to turn a nuclear power with I don't know the exact count, but nearly 300 million people into a pariah state just for the future of Afghanistan. This is not going to happen. It's not about what's fair or what's right. It's about realpolitik, and that's not going to happen. With some of the tools the U.S. has, such as perhaps assuring Pakistan that, you know, it's not going to invite India, the United States won't invite India to have a huge role in post-withdrawal Afghanistan, or that, hey, Pakistan, if you want us to, you know, perhaps make sure you don't get on the FATF blacklist, which is a blacklist for countries that have illicit financing, things like this, you know, there's little carrots and little sticks the United States might be able to use to alter some of Pakistan's calculation, and maybe even having a continued CT relationship could give the U.S. some influence. But I don't think it can alter the Pakistani military's fundamental calculation that India remains the greatest threat and it must be prioritized over all other things.
Well, I was hoping you could expand upon the U.S.'s relationship with India and how this you touched on it earlier, but how this kind of affects the calculus here, given who's in leadership in India right now, given the trajectory of that government and the posture they've taken towards Pakistan in the past few years.
Yeah, well, I mean, over the past few years, there's been a few skirmishes between Pakistan and India, and of course, all of those skirmishes always have the potential, as small as it may be, is of escalating into a nuclear exchange. And I think that remains one of the main worries of the U.S. government, which is that if there's a terrorist attack inside India and it triggers a conventional war, which we've seen these small skirmishes in the past few years, could it lead to a nuclear conflict? I think it's unlikely, but if it happened, it would be disastrous. And so U.S. policymakers are left worrying about the worst case scenarios, even though those scenarios might be unlikely because the repercussions of those scenarios would be so disastrous. Right now, relations between India and Pakistan, and that, you know, my focus is not India and Pakistan relations, but relations between those two countries is not that bad. It's not nearly as bad as it could be. It's, you know, there's been a few glimmers of hope. But I think with India, the more important thing to look at is that the Biden administration is prioritizing this Indo-Pacific strategy, this idea that India is a crucial partner in countering China, And so I think when the United States looks at India, it's looking eastward. It's not looking at Afghanistan and the rest of South Asia, for better or for worse. And so I think the focus is on China. And in some sense, that's probably what motivated the withdrawal decision, which is we're wasting time, you know, focusing on Afghanistan when we should be focusing on the rise of China. Now, I don't think that's the correct way to look at it. I don't think transitioning from a drawn out counterinsurgency campaign for the last 20 years to an obsession with great power competition, I don't think that's the right lesson to learn. But I do think that's what is partially motivating the Biden administration. And India is obviously a part of that.
Apropos of that point, the obsession with the great power, let's just go back to, Afghanistan is now on probably year 40, 42, 43 of essentially, you know, a rolling civil war. Will you remind people how we got into this? And by that, I mean, it was the Soviets. In our response to the Soviet Union that sort of like cycled this through on some level. And are there any lessons from this essentially 40-year chapter of, you know, more or less rubbling a country?
Well, I mean, you're one of the few hosts that acknowledges that point, that this is a 40-year civil war. It's actually really uncommon for a host to know that or acknowledge that. So thank you for that, because
I'm old.
it's an important point. And look, I think the U.S. role in the anti-Soviet jihad that occurred definitely destabilized Afghanistan to a degree, but I think it's important not to whitewash what the communist era, the domestic communist politics that happened in Afghanistan, because those governments were very brutal as well. Some of it's U.S. influence, some of it's dysfunction within Afghanistan, some of it's Pakistan. It's really complex. I think the lesson to learn is that the United States, number one, cannot dictate outcomes on the ground. And it certainly can't do it by using proxies or by putting U.S. boots on the ground. And number two, the United States should stop this pattern. It's like a pendulum where it interferes in Afghanistan and then it just withdraws completely from the region. I mean, we saw this in the 90s and then look what happened. And so the United States is engaged in this destructive pattern where it's either hyper-involved in meddling in the region or completely withdraws and then has to go back. And I think the real lesson here is that diplomacy and aid and economic development is measured in decades. You cannot dictate outcomes. Using proxies and U.S. troops is always a quick fix that creates more problems than it resolves. There's a lot of debate right now. Max Boot just had an article basically saying, don't give up counterinsurgency, in which he basically outlines a perfect scenario where counterinsurgency could work and says, what really happened in Iraq and Afghanistan is we fell short of doing it the right way. But of course, I don't think the U.S. government or any military would ever really be capable of doing counterinsurgency the right way. I'm willing to entertain Max Boot's argument that perhaps in some perfect vacuum of a scenario, counterinsurgency could be conducted the right way, but we don't have a good track record. And the fact that
does anybody does that exist in that is does it exist in anywhere other than fairy tales? That notion of this sort of clean counterinsurgency where there's no blowback and there's no, you're not creating enemies on the ground and you're not empowering, movements or groups that are going to end up being a problem 15 years from now.
Well, I certainly don't think it exists when it's a foreign power intervening to conduct the counterinsurgency. There's examples of insurgencies that have been defeated by, their co-nationalists, or perhaps Colombia is an example of that, or Sri Lanka is an example of that, although I'm not experts in those areas. So I don't take that with a grain of salt. But I don't think there's many examples, if any, where a foreign force has imposed its will in a counterinsurgency campaign and been very successful. I'm sure there's a historian who will listen to this who will find an example, but I think those examples are so few and far between that to base policy on that fantasy, which I think you say it correctly, it is a fantasy, would be, you know, it's foreign policy malpractice.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of the classic FU, which was the Freedmen Unit, when they talked about, I think it was Iraq. We just need six more months. That's the Freedmen Unit. And everything's going to be fine, named after Tom Friedman. All right. Just so lastly, well, I know we just have a minute here. Is Biden, the Biden $200 million, nonetheless, that probably should be, you know, 10 times that amount of money, maybe more, but it's so far, where are you surprised by what Biden has done? And do you, think it's, he's doing what he should be at this point?
Look, I applaud the Biden administration for withdrawing U.S. troops. I understand why they tried to engage in a Hail Mary of a diplomatic push before May 1, and they tried to get a political settlement. Although I always said that even if they did get a political settlement on paper, the vast majority of peace deals are never implemented. You can get it on paper. You can get all the warring factions into the same conference room, but good luck getting them to implement it. Especially without a third party that can enforce it. And the United States cannot be a third party that enforces a peace deal because the United States was a party to the conflict itself. It's like folks in Washington forget that. We were part of this war. We weren't some neutral party on the sideline. So I applaud the Biden administration's decision to bring U.S. troops home. I think it's critical that aid continue because the Afghan government will just come to a grinding halt if they don't get aid. Now, it's going to be a challenge because I don't think we should be supporting the kind of corruption and cronyism that we have for the last 20 years. And that's going to require some creativity. Perhaps the United States will be able to take a harder line on aid now that there's not U.S. troops on the ground. I think when U.S. troops were on the ground in Afghanistan, Washington was, turning a blind eye to a lot of corruption because, well, this is who we had to work with and U.S. lives were on the line. Now that U.S. lives aren't on the line, maybe, you know, they'll take a harder stance when it comes to corruption. I hope they do, but I also hope they continue the funding and don't let the perfect become the enemy of the good when it comes to conditioning aid. It will take time for, you know, the Afghan government to get rid of the kind of corruption we've seen. And I'm not one who believes in just handing out aid willy-nilly, but in this case, I think there's somewhat of a moral responsibility to do it just because we were so much a part of the destabilization of this country. So I applaud the Biden administration so far. I hope they follow through with it. And I think what's going to be important is not to let folks like Max Boot and others whitewash the last 20 years.
Hear. Adam Weinstein, research fellow at the Quincy Institute. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a break, folks. But when you hear the words Max Boot, run for the hills.
Put on your boots and run for the hills.
Exactly. These neocons have come out of the woodwork. And as far as, you know, providing aid, I am also old enough to remember the promises that were made, if not directly to the Afghani people, but to the American people in terms of what our intentions were in Afghanistan. And we were adamant. We were not going to leave that place in ruins. It was to the extent that there was any criticism of George Bush, specifically around that, it was he had promised not to be a nation builder. And here he is saying that we're going to Afghanistan and rebuilding a nation. But yeah, that didn't quite happen. There were some improvements in at least within Kabul, but $200 million. My God, that's like Jeff Bezos is like, I don't know, budget for red wine for a year or something.
Yeah, it's the equivalent.
I don't even know
if
he drinks a lot, but I'm sure the bottles he gets are really expensive.
It's the equivalent of us, you know, sending a pizza.
It's crazy. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will wrap things up in just a moment. So we were talking about Joe Manchin up front. And I mean, the gloves are off a little bit for progressives, at least in the House, regarding Joe Manchin. And this is one of those things where it's like, I think Joe Manchin's pretty happy about it. And so here's Jamal Bowman. Let's do our part in providing Joe Manchin what he wants with progressives in the House criticizing him.
Manchin is a no on doing anything to end the filibuster. He put it in writing. Your reaction?
Joe Manchin has become the new Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell, during Obama's presidency, said he would do everything in his power to stop Obama. He's also repeated that now during the Biden presidency by saying he would do everything in his power to stop President Biden. And now Joe Manchin is doing everything in his power to stop democracy and to stop our work for the people, the work that the people sent us here to do. H.R. 1 not only is a huge bill when it comes to voting rights, it's a huge bill in terms of getting big money out of politics, protecting our elections against fraud, and ending gerrymandering. I mean, big money in politics is what's destroying our democracy, and the Republican Party is aiding and abetting that, and Donald Trump is obviously doing that as well. So Manchin is not pushing us closer to bipartisanship. He is doing the work of the Republican Party by being an obstructionist, just like they've been since the beginning of Biden's presidency.
So well, you love it. Look, and, yeah, go on.
I mean, it's possible that, you know, everybody was like, you know, this is what Joe wants. Let's give it to him. And the more he gets of this, the closer he'll get to. I'm still in my optimistic mode, Emma. It's Monday, trying to give people optimism that'll carry through the week.
And all right, so, well, don't stop there. I mean, we need to have AOC on the airwaves saying Joe Manchin single-handedly ended socialism in America. God, I mean, why did he just, like, obstruct our socialist agenda like this?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, I think if she was to buy that billboard and put it up in West Virginia, Joe Manchin would be ecstatic. And maybe there is. Maybe there just is. And again, I know this is hopelessly optimistic, maybe not hopelessly, but exceedingly optimistic. Maybe there is a metric where Manchin looks at and it says, okay, I have now sufficiently made it clear that I am not one of those type of Democrats. And now I can vote for this or that. I mean,
he'll do that. Today, but.
Yeah, he'll do that just as there's not enough time for us to start working on cinema.
Well, I'll tell you something. The other concern I have is that this is going to chew up a lot of time. And even putting aside the prospect of one of the exceedingly old members of our Senate having health problems, we're also going to start getting close to the 22 election. And that's also maybe part of the project. But hope springs eternal. We have plenty of time to bemoan the fact that Joe Manchin is thwarting an agenda that Joe Biden made it clear he knew how to operate in these waters. So ultimately, it's on him. We'll have more to say for the rest of the week. Until then, on behalf of Emma Vigeland, if you are watching us on Peacock, we say adieu, which means goodbye, French.
So, why are you speaking in a different language?
Well,
commie.
I don't know. I don't know why I did that, but that's just what came to me at the time. Yeah, this Joe Manchin thing. What a way to wake up in the morning. I mean, I you know, honestly, like,
I saw it over the weekend, and I saw the op-ed, and my boyfriend was like, wasn't this clear? You know, didn't he already make this position about the filibuster clear? And I'm like, well, honestly, sort of, but not really, because he keeps going back and forth. I mean, but this is the second op-ed he's taken out.
It is the second op-ed. I do think that one needs to recognize that he's probably calibrating. what he says for his local audience versus what he says for his national audience. I mean, from our perspective,
although that first op-ed was in the Washington Post.
Yes. From our perspective, there is no difference, right? I mean, I access the West Virginia Gazette as easy as I access the Washington Post. I have no allegiance to either one. I don't trust one more than the other. I imagine for his constituents, though, the West Virginia Gazette carries more relevance. They're not necessarily your average person's not reading the Washington Post for editorials from your senator. Your average person doesn't care. And he's trying to make a brand in there for himself and wants, you know, the certain fealty to it. And, you know, maybe he also has some sincere beliefs about the Senate and democracy and hugging everybody and
being bipartisan for bipartisanship's sake is just one of the most childish notions I can think of, because you're not even looking at the merits of each position in and of themselves. If you're saying you're intellectually honest, you're just kind of subscribing to a vague sense of harmony without ever contextualizing what that means.
It is, I mean, it is fascinating because he does believe, and he may not. I mean, I don't know, you know, what's in his heart of hearts, right? But his belief system seems to be that the existence of bipartisanship is a fundamental necessity for a functioning democracy. And in fact, it is largely the opposite. Functioning democracies involve people, groups, whether it's a parliamentary system or in this case, you know, our duopoly of parties, it involves conflict, not necessarily not armed conflict, but political conflict. That's the whole point. And the reason why you have a democratic system, ostensibly have a democratic system, is to work this out in a relatively peaceful manner. But if you short circuit the ability to work it out and you just have the country not address its problems or even not allow different dispositions to address its problems. I mean, you contemplate, like, what has been the major pieces of legislation that we have seen over the past 5 years now, actually 7 years, like, I mean, 8 years. The last, like, significant piece of legislation that we had, I think, was the ACA. And this is through two different parties having a, you know, this is a slim majority for the Democrats, but the Republicans had a majority. And,
well, I mean, you're not counting the 2017 tax cuts as significant.
The tax cuts, I mean, yes, okay, but that's really just a rate change, right? I mean, there's no like fundamental.
Well, they're not going to build anything, so please.
Well, I mean, it's not inconceivable that a Republican Party could have an agenda. It just so happens that they have no agenda outside of cutting taxes. That's the nature of their. But Republican parties in the past have had an agenda, and there's been no expression of that whatsoever. Our government is not doing anything, at least, or making any changes. Like, somehow everything's fine. And so it's incredibly frustrating. And, you know, I don't know, maybe we'll do the what was the optimist option? Maybe we'll do that, like, you know, once a week.
The optimism option. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little corny, but
a little corny. Probably would do gangbusters. We'll do that on that. We'll do it on PodSave. We'll do it on, like, whatever their network is.
Right.
The optimist option.
We should pitch. We should pitch the optimism option to Crooked Media.
Folks, going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder: this show cannot exist without your support. We get ads time to time. Some days better than others, but the ads don't come anywhere near supporting us like members do. It is your support that keeps this show going. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the fun half free of commercials. Excuse me, the free half free of commercials. The fun half also free of commercials. Of course, if you're a member, you can always check out the our deals. Most of these places that advertise through us give us some type of break. And you can find those at in our YouTube or in our podcast descriptions. So check it out. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And also check out the AM Quickie. 7 minutes every morning of headline news. And don't forget, Nomi's channel, youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. And today they have the committee on with Arun Chaudhary. You can check that out, 3 p.m. What else we got? Oh, and don't forget the Discord, majoritydiscord.com. Matt, what's happening in the Leckian media universe?
Yeah, tonight for patrons of Left Reckoning, patreon.com/LeftReckoning, David Griscom and I are reacting to and watching a debate between Winnipeg, Canada, Manitoba-based, or originally from socialist Leo Panitch, debating two capitalists at the same time. So that's for patrons tonight, probably about 7:30 Eastern or so. patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get access to that.
Two on one.
Yeah, it's kind of irritating, I guess, but Panitch is good.
I thought you were delving into hockey since the Winnipeg Jets are in the playoffs.
No, I'm not super familiar with Winnipeg's hockey team or sports in general. In fact, as a North Dakotan, I assumed Winnipeg was a much smaller town until pretty late in life that I find that it's actually much bigger than anything in North Dakota.
The University of North Dakota, you guys got a good hockey team there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be back to talk about the Red Sox sweep in just a moment. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow. But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
Hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.